Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 1:20 p.m. and that is July 8th. And today being Friday, it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Now, I thought we'd kick off with a reasonably long term chart of the ratio between copper and gold, because it's generally looked upon within the bond markets as being a lead indicator for where yields are likely to go. And we've been certainly looking at these upper side of the range tests and a failed upside break last November, and then it's contracted more recently. So copper prices have come back really quite aggressively over the last week, and of course so have golds. But when we start to think about inflation, well, there's obviously a couple of different points. The first is that it's exceptionally high right now, and it's a truly global phenomenon. And or I guess it's the perception is that it's a truly global phenomenon, but inflation in China hasn't been as high. Now, that's also proof, or it's a proof point to point towards exactly why we've had this inflation. China did not engage in the same practice of shoving money down the throats of the consumer during the worst effects of the pandemic shutdowns. They didn't cut interest rates to zero. So everywhere else went into these massive money printing regimes. So if we think about then, where is the inflation after coming from? Well, we can look at what's happened in China relative to everywhere else, and it's primarily about demand. If it were truly about a supply problem, then exports from China would have gone down, but that's not what happened. China's trade surplus surged. So this has been more about demand shocking the supply system, and then having serious knock-on effects because the supply system just was not able to keep up with the volume of new demand. So we have had inflation, and the inflation has lasted longer than the central banks of the world thought was possible. But now we're in an evolving, different scenario, because bond yields pulled back rather sharply last week and then rebounded this week and are pushing back above the 3% level. So this is still an uptrend, and it just about held the sequence of higher reaction lows. And with this week's upward dynamic, this is looking more like a consolidation in the region of the upper side of this decade-long range than a failed upside break. So it is pointing towards the real possibility that the Federal Reserve is going to raise rates again by 75 basis points at the end of this month, and then by another 50 basis points at the September meeting. So that's going to take interest rates up to 3%. And the 10-year yield is pricing in the potential that they're probably not going to go or not successfully raise rates beyond that level at any point in the next decade. Now, when we look at the yield curve spread, it's, I think, particularly relevant that we're in a similar type of condition to what we had in 2006, where we had a very mild inverted condition, a rebound, and then subsequently it became inverted again. And because we didn't have a recession immediately after the first inversion in early 2006, then the market started to ignore the signal. And then we subsequently saw it become inverted and stay inverted for longer. And then subsequently, we had the recession unfold. And I suspect that's exactly what we're going to have now, because We know that financial conditions are tightening. Now, this is a purely monetary event. So, on the it's not, I should say, it's not only a monetary event, but the market is, and I think investors and the financial media are concentrating on interest rate hikes. But there are two additional sources of financial tightening that are underway. So, not only is the Federal Reserve raising interest rates, but we're seeing interest rates rising everywhere else. Now, it's easy to then think about that and say, well, the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates faster than everyone else. And that's, of course, supporting the dollar. But the very fact that the dollar is rising so quickly is siphoning money out of everywhere else. So, there's the real scope for a large number of countries to experience really significant challenges because of the dearth of dollars. So this very strong dollar environment is a really challenging problem for countries like El Salvador or Ghana, Egypt or Tunisia, Pakistan, Argentina, Turkey, and all of these smaller and somewhat, and some of them larger countries that have historically had dodgy credit ratios. And now the significant issue that we have with inflationary pressures and our strong dollar, and then also high commodity prices, because the strong dollar mitigates some of the inflationary pressures for the USA. But it makes the inflationary pressure worse everywhere else. So that's an additional factor that not only are do we have tighter financial conditions because the Federal Reserve is raising rates faster than most of the other, mostly just about every other central bank in the world, and definitely faster than the developed markets, but then the currency's also weighing. And these are just the obvious ones. Then we have the fact that the Federal Reserve is just beginning to reduce the size of its balance sheet. So when we look at the size of the balance sheet, it was at 9 trillion not all that long ago, and they're taking about 47.5 billion out of circulation this month. And that's going to ramp up to about 95 billion in September. So we've already seen significant volatility in the stock market. And there's a large number of the high growth indices are right in the region of their respective 1,000-day moving averages. And this is the time where if the secular trend is going to remain intact, we should anticipate support starting to come back in. So we've definitely seen at least some evidence of support coming back in. But we have to remind ourselves that these periods of quantitative tightening don't last 1 month. And the last time it lasted for about 18 months. Now, when we think about the Federal Reserve, they don't just look at the absolute figure. So what they do is there, and this was what Jay Powell said when he testified in front of the of Congress just last month. And what he said was that they look at the total assets relative to GDP. Now, if we look at what that looks like over a lengthier period of time, and we can then think that what the Fed is really thinking about is that they weren't just in a period of quantitative tightening in 2018 and 19, but that, in fact, they believe that their conditions had been tightening all the way through 2014. All the way through to 2019, because the size of the balance sheet was not rising as fast as GDP. But then you look at what's happening now. So obviously we had this phenomenally large advance in 2020, where the size of the balance sheet doubled during the pandemic relative to GDP. The only time we've had moves of that magnitude was in 2008, where the size of the balance sheet was around 0.6 and it went to 1.5. So it's a bit more than a double. Then we've had the periods of less commitment to quantitative easing, QE1, QE2, QE, what felt like forever. And we saw that it went from 1.5 to 2.5. So as we can see very clearly now, the size of the balance sheet relative to GDP has peaked, but it's not really falling. And until it starts to fall, then inflationary pressures are likely to remain front and center. So this represents the potential for significant additional tightening. And obviously, this is significant. Now, so that's a third form of tightening. But the first two are already in the price. And the extent to which this third one will be in the price hasn't is still uncertain. Investors are willing to believe that they're not that committed. And they're talking about the process of interest rate hikes starting to slow down from September, and potentially that will be the end of the interest rate hiking cycle. So if we look at the 2-year yield, and of course we have an inverted yield curve, or as close as, so the 2-year yield is around 3.11%. So it's pricing in half a 25 basis point hike beyond September. So this isn't an especially ambitious forecast for what interest rates are likely to be 2 years forward. So obviously, investors are willing to bet that not only will the Federal Reserve not be able to raise rates, but that they won't be able to engage in quantitative tightening either. And that's in direct response to the threat of a significant fallback in demand as the fourth type of tightening takes place, which is government spending. So the really attractive spending programs installed as in response to the pandemic have pretty much run off. And the last big one is on student debt in the USA. So that's obviously going to be a really significant challenge. What they're talking about is extending it potentially even further, and that they're not going to cancel the debt. So the big challenge for the in particularly in the USA, this issue with the student debt is that it's floating rate. As interest rates rise, the interest on that debt goes up faster, and obviously that's a challenge. And a lot of that debt incurs interest from the day it's taken out. So even though a student is doesn't have to start paying it back until after they've finished their degree and earn or are earning money, they could have been rolling on interest in the loan for 7 years, because it might take them 4 or 6 years to finish their degree and maybe another year to find a job that could justify making payments on the debt. So then the quantity of money that they have borrowed will have increased. And because it's cumulative and then also floating rate, well, That wasn't problematic when interest rates were zero, but 3% compounding on a rate that's not or on a balance that's not being reduced is seriously problematic. And that's going to form a for, another form of tightening when people have to start paying that debt back again. So we're definitely looking at less government spending, central banks that are both raising rates and reducing the size of their balance sheets, and a dollar that has broken higher. So these are really significant forms of tightening. Now, when we think then about what everything else that's going on in the world. So if it was simply that we had a pandemic and we spent too much and we were coming out of the pandemic, well, then that would probably be challenging, but probably not all that difficult to manage. But then we have what's going on with between Russia and Europe. So the Netherlands gas price was back in the region of the high in here today. Now the price is up, and I think it's been quoted as up 7 times, and it is up 7 times since the beginning of 2021. But prior to 2021, it didn't really spend a lot of time around the 20 level. It might be more correct to say that it's broken out of the base formation, and the base formation was around 40. So it's not quite up 4 times. But a jump of 4 times in the price of natural gas is significant. And we can think about the industrial portion of the German economy. So when we think about the chemicals sector that consumes natural gas, then the price is back in the region of the 1,000-day moving average for a dollar investor, but has pulled back significantly. But again, this is holding the sequence of higher reaction lows. Then let's just think about a company that manages property. And a lot of those leases mean that the property manager has to cover the price of energy. So, the price of Vonovia has gone from 50 before the invasion to 28. Now it's trading at a reasonable PE of 10 and yields nearly 6%. But they're going to have to ration heating. So hot water is going to become a rare commodity during the winter. These are seriously problematic events. You have the German foreign minister intervening with Canada to try and free up the export of, or I guess it's the shipping of a turbine back to Russia, so that they'll hopefully start up the Nord Stream 1 pipeline. But Russia, all it has to do is wait. And Europe is going to be in really significant stress this winter. And this war in Ukraine does not look like it's going to end quickly. What we're definitely then looking at is the pressure on a country like Germany to re-militarize. And they haven't been investing in their military for decades. So Bund yields have surged higher. In March of 2020, they were at a negative yield of 1%. Now the yield is at 1.3%. So we've had 260 basis points of movement. But this looks like a clear new uptrend. It's a very different chart from what we saw in the USA, where we have this lengthier base formation. and the yield is in the region of the upper side of the base. And it's still argumentative whether it's going to surge on the upside. But bund yields have, and so have gilt yields. So there's very strong commonality in some of these European bond yield charts. And the gilt yield continues to hold the sequence of higher reaction lows, and it's back at around the 2.25 level. Well, in just the same way that floating rate loans are problematic for student loan borrowers in the USA, they're problematic for mortgage holders in the UK. So the Bank of England is talking about the potential that the consumer could tolerate a move to 5%. Well, that's going to be really problematic for a lot of people. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be, and of course, what they're thinking about is, and unfortunately, this is how central banks think, they're going to look at the people who don't own their property, the people who are on mortgages, and then the people who own their properties without a mortgage. And then they aggregate the figures and they'll say, well, on aggregate, then the economy could probably tolerate a 5% mortgage rate. But it's obviously not going to fall evenly on everyone. So this is obviously problematic. Now, when we go back then and think of these stock markets. So the DAX index is in positive territory today, and it's short-term oversold. So there's certainly the scope for an unwinding of the short-term oversold condition. And interestingly, it's the automotive companies are bouncing here. So it's Porsche and Volkswagen, Mercedes and Daimler Truck, Continental are among the better performers in here today. And then we have, for example, BMW announcing that their sales of internal combustion engine cars have fallen aggressively, but that they're on track to double their sales of electric vehicles. And that has been beneficial for companies like Taiwan Semiconductor. So Taiwan Semiconductor is back in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And we clearly had an acceleration. The price went from 40 to 140 in the space of a year, then pulled back, had a failed upside break, and then declined exceptionally precipitously. And just about pulled back by 50%. So 50% pullback is generally enough to get people interested in buying again. And the surge in demand for chips for cars is offsetting the lack of demand from the PC sector, or I guess it's the lack of demand growth from the PC and smartphone sectors. Samsung also came through with really impressive earnings. So if we look at the GDR listed in the UK, the price came from over 2,000 down to 1,000, and we're seeing the first evidence of support starting to come through from a deep oversold condition. So there's the potential that we could get a short covering rally. But this is in the context of monetary and fiscal conditions that are still tightening. And the whole rationale behind the bull market for the last 14 years has been the availability of credit. So when we have loose monetary and fiscal conditions, asset prices float higher. But now we have real discount rates. And an The reintroduction of a discount rate is having a traumatic effect on valuations for the most risky portions of the market. So, when we think then about some of the companies that were really making the running in 2021, well, Peloton Interactive has failed to rebound. So, it's still hovering here. Now, we might just say, well, let's forget about what it did before. And it had the upside Q reversal on Tuesday, but no real evidence of follow-through and still has a sequence of lower rally highs. And it's down from $100 in September to 10. So certainly you'll have people that will want to buy the dip around the 50% decline level. But then you'll also have people that will think, well, if it's down 90%, then perhaps it's time to start thinking about buying it. But the share doesn't even have a PE, and they don't make any money. So they're anticipating that they'll lose 2.5 billion, and potentially might even trim that to 2 billion. By the end of this year, and that they might squeeze out a profit of 53 million on a market cap of 3.4 billion by the end of the year or within 12 months. And I just think that that's ambitious. Then we can think about Airbnb. So this is a company that has done exceptionally well in capturing market share. And it also had a little upside Q reversal on Tuesday and has at least followed through on the upside. Now, we're still considerably below where the IPO level was, although I guess it is worth highlighting that the IPO was at 68 and then it immediately opened higher. But it's still a downtrend overall. Now, we can think about a company like Airbnb. So it does have a PE, and that PE is expected to halve over the course of this year. And that at least helps to justify some of the valuation. And Airbnb is likely to move more into Booking.com's wheelhouse and start offering booking facilities for lots of other accommodation solutions, as well as the large number of people who are offering rental accommodation as short-term rentals within their platform at present. But that takes it into a very different business model and makes it much more competitive with the booking type companies. So the booking companies aren't trending higher either, and Booking.com has begun to pull back. And of course, part of the reason that it's pulling back is because of the weakness in the airlines sector. So we think, for example, about American Airlines, and the share price has come back into the region of the lows from 2020, and it's just beginning to steady. We can think about British Airways, and let's just say, what do they call themselves now? Consolidated Airlines. So, IAG. And lots of these airlines have been canceling. They've been canceling flights left and right over the course of the last few weeks, whether that's been in the USA or in Europe. And a good part of the reason for it is because of the lack of workers. Now, some of that is because of the pandemic. So, if we think about where the challenges are, we have certainly got monetary and fiscal tightening. And then we have the war in Ukraine. So that's obviously weighing on the European economy in particular. And most particularly, it's because of energy prices. So If we look then at the oil price, oil prices are still around this $100 area and rebounded quite impressively yesterday. But high oil prices are a tax on consumption. And that is most graphically seen by the fact that the strength of the dollar has actually contained some of that inflationary pressure for the USA, whereas in most other countries, the price of oil is at a new all-time high or very close to it. So this is another tax on consumption. So again, this is very similar to the kinds of conditions that we had in 2006, that oil prices were surging higher. Then they really accelerated higher in 2008, and that choked off demand for just about everything. And the process of interest rate hiking, it takes time to have an effect, but it will have an effect. So this is very clearly pointing towards a significant fall off in demand as we move progressively further into this tightening regime. Now let's think then about the response militarily to Russia. So the first thing is that Europe does not want to leave Russia in such an exposed position that their only choice would be to use tactical nuclear weapons. So they want to hold Russia in Ukraine. And that would appear to be just direct policy, that there will be what is effectively trench warfare in Ukraine, where they'll be lobbing bits of metal at each other for the foreseeable future. And they'll attempt to bleed the Russian economy dry. And hopefully, then Russia will pack up and go home, and that's what they, I think, probably hope for. But of course, Ukrainians might have something to say about that. And the dynamics of war are such that we have to be prepared for surprises. That you're talking about a highly capable, intelligent fighting force that has got both challenges and advantages, and there will be ingenious solutions to what are considered to be intransient problems. And that is equally true of both sides of the fight. So we can anticipate that there are going to be more surprises. And that's not really being priced into stock markets at present. Stocks are willing to think that the war in Ukraine is now at a stalemate, and perhaps at a stalemate by design. And the conclusion is that Russia will be happy for that to remain the case. So that's obviously not something that we should be betting on, because it's not a guarantee by any means. And this high energy price is something that's particularly relevant. But what I think is also relevant is that commodity prices have not come back down. Now, we've had a meaningful correction, for example, in copper. And copper prices dropped below $4 area, and it looks like a type 2 top formation with a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, and then bounced from the region of the 1,000-day moving average in here today, or I should say this week. So the big question now is, how much of a rally are we going to get? Could the price get all the way back up towards $4? And the answer is, it absolutely could. Now, I'm still short, but I have a fairly tight in the money stop. So if prices move very much beyond the peak from yesterday, I'll be taken out of this position. But the challenge here, or I guess the bigger message, is that copper has not, at least not yet, declined back to $2. When we think about nickel, for example. Now, nickel has had this extraordinary volatility, and the shenanigans that have been going on within the nickel price would make anybody blush. The full details of this spike higher, which was this huge short covering rally, and then oodles of trades being cancelled, and the people who were long, in fact, having to pony up funds for being right, because the Chinese businessman who had one of the largest short positions in history simply refused to pony up the funds that he'd lost. And it is a clear signal that you don't have a efficiently functioning market. And when you're such a large player, you can dictate terms to the exchange. So this is definitely going to have a deleterious effect on sentiment in, or at least in faith, of the London Metal Exchange to do its job. But the other important point is nickel prices are coming down, but they have not dropped back down to 10,000, even though they've pulled back meaningfully from that spiky peak. We saw a rather impressive rebound in palladium prices in here today. So, palladium is maybe a unique example because when prices went from 500 to 3,000, it would be normal in just in past cycles to expect substitution. And substitution hasn't happened because of the desire of the automotive sector to just get rid of internal combustion engine manufacturing. So that's, I think, one of the factors that's helped the price continue to rise. And it's bounced in here today. Now, Norilsk Nickel is the biggest producer of palladium, and that's no longer traded. And Sibanye-Stillwater had a flood in its Montana mines, and it bought Stillwater, which is a producer of palladium, and the share has halved over the course of the last year. So it's just beginning to steady now, and it's a producer of both platinum, palladium, nickel, and then gold, and it's one of the higher yield gold miners, and at least showing some evidence of support building. We had a meaningful breakdown this week in the gold market. Now, gold is responding to the reality that the Federal Reserve is serious about trying to get its credibility back and is pushing and talking about pushing the rates up into restrictive territory, which basically means positive real interest rates. Well, a lot of people consider gold an asset that does well in negative real interest rate environments. So if the Fed is going for positive real interest rates, then that's not great news for gold. But gold is still in the region of the peak from back in 2011, and it's nowhere near pulling back to where the lows were in 2015, much less where the lows were in 2000. So we don't have a lot of commodities that have pulled back in are sufficiently to push back down into their base formations. So we can think about copper prices, where it got all the way up to test the highs from back in 2008, 11, and 12. But then failed and came back down meaningfully. A move from 800 to 600 is a big move. But now we're starting to see support starting to come back in. What I think is that there's a lot of risk assets are short-term oversold. And we're still in an environment where there is a lot of tightening going on. Now, one of the things that we see in the latter stages of bull markets, after we've had a big pullback, there's this exceptionally powerful buy the dip mentality. And that's what I think we're seeing right now. We're seeing a lot of markets that have pulled back by some in the case of 50%, a number that are testing their respective 1,000-day moving averages, and lots of people thinking, well, this is a buying opportunity. And every other time in the last 14 years that these assets have pulled back in a violent manner has been a buying opportunity, so that's what I'm going to do. And that's dangerous in an environment where we have monetary conditions that are still tightening. The best time to buy is after a big pullback when monetary conditions and fiscal conditions are going in your favor. So I guess an easy way of saying that is don't fight the Fed. And the Fed wants asset prices to come back. So if we think about the Shiller home price indicator. It was last updated at the end of April and has gone from about 200 at the beginning of 2018 to 300. So we've had a 50% advance in home prices in the space of about 4 years, which is truly spectacular. And it's still rising. So we're still in an environment where unemployment has not spiked on the upside. We're in an environment where house prices are still very strong. And the fact that car companies are starting to bounce and chip manufacturers are saying that they still have robust demand, that gives central banks a lot of leeway to continue to raise interest rates and restrict access to liquidity. So I think that we have the scope in the short term for rebounds. And I was highlighting the ARK Innovation ETF last week as being one of those candidates because it has already pulled back so violently. But is it going to be capable of sustaining a move above the 200-day moving average? One of the things we'll often see after an accelerated decline like this is a 100% move from trough to peak, and then subsequently prices come all the way back down. So this is obviously challenging. Now, I've talked about some of the things that are challenging for Europe and the fact that we're still in a tightening environment, but it is worth then thinking about what's going on in China. So China is still adopting this COVID zero policy, and that's about control. China has a significant debt issue, and they have lots of state-owned companies that are seriously over-levered. And they went through this phenomenally large building program, and lots of the homes that have been built are vacant, and their urbanization trend is pretty much over, and the population is aging, so they don't have as many young people as they used to. So that's going to be more difficult to continue to sell stuff. And the credit impulse has turned. So that suggests that China didn't engage in the same quantity of quantitative easing, but that it is now likely to act in a supportive market for the economy because the consumer is under duress. And some of the high frequency data, like the bookings on the internal high-speed railway. Well, they've been falling precipitously. Now, that's an exceptionally debt-ridden portion of the economy, and it took oodles of cash to build that high-speed train network, and I've been on it, and it's really phenomenal. You can go from Shanghai down to Hangzhou in about 90 minutes, and it's a really comfortable ride. And I don't think anyone is under any illusion that it's expensive to build that kind of infrastructure. And right now, there's nobody on it. So this is obviously problematic. And China went through a significant tightening. They really tried to snuff out some of the more speculative activity in the housing market during the pandemic. And now they're looking at the real potential that growth went into reverse in the first quarter. Now, that is not going to be reported, but growth is certainly contracting, and this is the time where they will start to produce additional liquidity. So it's not a truly global liquidity tightening program because China is going the other way. But if we look at the credit impulse chart, well, the reality is that we're getting diminishing returns. China printed a ton of money in 2008 and 9. Then it printed less in 2012 and 13, and it's printed about the same amount over the last two surges. But the growth that it's been getting for those money printing cycles has been declining, and a lot of the growth in the economy over the last decade has been debt fueled. So we should look at that in the context of the social credit program, the tightening up of the control mechanisms over the economy, and the complete willingness to abandon any kind of sensitivity to human rights. All of these factors are completely tied together. So the Chinese renminbi continues to steady versus the US dollar. And they're talking about bringing forward some of the borrowing capacity from next year into this year. So that could be $220 billion of funding. For an economy the size of China, that's supportive, but it's probably not as supportive as needs to be. And then Shinzo Abe was assassinated in Japan this morning. He championed the redefinition of the pacifist constitution for Japan. Now, there were celebrations in China this morning because of that news. And those were quickly damped down by the communist administration. But what it definitely highlights is that China has been fostering a nationalist fervor within the economy. And Russia's been doing the same thing. And China and Russia have allied with one another. Now, it's a complicated situation for China because the government has allied with Russia. But a lot of the biggest companies that have got businesses overseas, they can't deal with Russia because they don't want to be seen to be breaking US sanctions. So what we have with China is they're in with one leg and out with the other in terms of their relationship with Russia. But China is very actively militarizing. So when South Korea, Taiwan, and Japan look at that phenomenon, they're presented with with a clear decision. Do they want to wake up one day with Chinese aircraft carriers, destroyers, and a flotilla of smaller vessels in their main harbors? Or are they going to build their own navies? Are they going to build their own air defenses? Are they going to get more aggressive in countermeasures? So it suggests that we are moving into a much more militarized environment. A lot of the European defense sector popped on the upside immediately after the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. And BAE Systems has done a bit better than most, that it popped on the upside, it kept going, and so far now is holding this breakout to new highs. So it's trending higher. We had a really impressive move by Rheinmetall, and Saab was another company that popped on the upside and looks almost identical to Rheinmetall. Mitsubishi Heavy has a contract with the USA to build the F-35 stealth fighter. And in 2020, they decided that they were not going to shut it down, but that they were going to become more efficient in production. So the share has also rallied in 2022, and it's been exceptionally volatile. But it's exceptionally volatile in an environment where they really were constrained by the pacifist constitution. And there's the real possibility that Japan is going to abandon that pacifism and become much more activist in increasing its military firepower. Now, there was a long time after World War II that both Japan and Germany were not allowed to have big militaries because the world was not going to deal with that again. But now the world needs Germany and Japan to remilitarize as a way of helping the rest of the world deal with some of the problems arising from Russia and China. Now, you generally get remilitarization before you get outright wars. So it would suggest that China and Russia have been remilitarizing for a while, and Russia is already pressing the initiative. Obviously, if China is going to make a move, it would be smart to do it before Japan militarizes, because it's going to be an awful lot more difficult to do it afterwards. When we think about Taiwan, well, it's obviously heavily influenced by the semiconductors index, and it's bouncing from the 1,000-day moving average at present. As companies start to deal with the reality of a militaristic China, well, they don't have a lot of alternatives about where they're going to find lots of young, cheap labor. And India really is the only place to go if you want to have a single country where you have oodles of young labor. But the Indian rupee is rapidly depreciating. So, of course, that's going to enhance the attraction of the low wages and the competitiveness of the environment. But from an institutional or a foreign investor's perspective, the best time to buy India is following the big pullbacks and the times when the rupee, in fact, finds support for a couple of years at a time. But India does look like the kind of place that will benefit. And there's obviously issues with governance. And the Modi government is becoming progressively more nationalistic and Hindu concentrated in its outlook, and that is troubling. There's no question that outright nationalism and stirring up nationalist fervor and then pitting one religious group against another has a really troubling history wherever it has been tried internationally and literally forever. So that's obviously a challenge when it comes to India. But India has unique benefits that make it attractive to international investors, and the most important of those is it's not China. Now, then of course, there is the additional question about Saudi Arabia. So, Saudi Arabia and Iran are never on the best of terms. And Iran is moving progressively towards a nuclear weapon. And how much patience do Israel and Saudi Arabia have to allow that kind of event to take place? Obviously, India is a major importer of oil from Russia. It's a major importer of oil from the Middle East. They're now importing 1 million barrels a day from Russia, and they're benefiting from the low price that that achieves. They're also skirting some of the sanctions because the rest of the world cannot afford to, I think, piss off the Indian government. The rest of the world needs India because India is on the front line with China. So, manufacturing will migrate there. And the reality is that India has some of the access to lower energy prices. So that's a benefit for India. And then the question is, how are they going to get the infrastructure up and running, and will they build more factories? And I think the answer is yes. So there is obviously a lot of volatility in the world. Some countries are going to come out in a stronger position. Others are going to have a more difficult position. And then you have Australia. And Australia isn't called the lucky country for no reason. So the ASX 200 is steadying in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Now we can also see that the trend hasn't been especially consistent over the last 14 years, and there have been plenty of times when the index was below that 1,000-day moving average. And despite the fact that Australia has a really exceptionally vibrant healthcare sector and a big services industry, it is often considered a major commodity exporter. So the extent to which China is willing to support infrastructure development and consumption of major commodities is obviously going to be a significant factor for Australia. But then, of course, Australia is now also a major exporter of natural gas. So natural gas prices are likely to be a really significant factor for Australia. And then we can think about the Australian dollar. So it's a little steadier in here today. It has not accelerated lower through the 70-cent level, but the absolute minimum requirement is that it will need to sustain a move high enough to break the sequence of lower rally highs, and at the very minimum, trade back above the 70-cent level. But India will benefit from increasing energy demand internationally, and supply of gas is going to be a significant portion of that. Of course, Australia is also a major exporter of coal. And when natural gas is in short supply, well, coal is a valuable commodity. So then we can think about some of the not just thermal coal, but metallurgical coal. And Whitehaven is back in the region of its peaks from 2011 and 2018, and firming in a more convincing way. So there is certainly potential here that we're going to have higher energy prices, and oil bouncing from the $100 area. It's still in a rangy environment, and we have this big argument about whether the efforts by Russia to try and support the price of oil, because they're trying to defend their currency, So they cut off supply from Kazakhstan to the Black Sea because they were trying to defend the currency. And we get a live quote when we compare it to the euro. I do think that that was one of the factors in the weakness of gold this week, that the ruble weakened in line with the oil price. So they sold some gold to support the currency. What that suggests now is that there is going to be a high correlation between gold and oil. If oil prices continue higher, the ruble will be well supported and there won't be as much gold coming into the market. If oil pulls back, then the ruble will not be supported and they'll be forced to sell everything else. That could weigh on gold, it could weigh on palladium and nickel as well. So, there's certainly a lot going on in the energy market. The bullish case is obviously that Russia will continue to cause mischief in the market. And the bearish case is that we're in for a really significant demand shock in the second half of this year because all of these competing forms of monetary tightening are going to start to come to bear. So we can think then that we've got the potential for short-term rallies, but that until monetary conditions turn around, it's going to be a volatile environment and it'll be difficult to argue that the lows are in fact in. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend and I'll wish all the best to all of you.